Many years ago, there was a local elder who many of you will remember in the Cleveland West Church, back when we had a West and East Church, named Rob Lee Evans. Rob Lee Evans was very kind to my wife and me. I used to call him my guru. He always hated that. But he was a somewhat grumpy old man who always had something to add to my life, it seemed like. And I remember him saying one day, "You know, you've kind of got it made." And I didn't know what he meant. But I've probably been to more weddings than anybody in this room, simply because I play at a lot of weddings. I had the opportunity to play at David and Stephanie's this summer. Very happy to do that kind of thing. But there were weekends in Pasadena where I would play for three or four weddings, and sometimes I knew the people and sometimes I didn't. So I've been to a lot of weddings. And he turned to Matthew 24, which we will do, it was a chapter that we pretty much had memorized anyway. I mean, this was the focal chapter of our church at that point, and in some ways still is when it comes to God's plan and what we're looking forward to. But in Matthew 24, he mentioned the verses that start in verse 37, where Jesus is referring to the fact that nobody knows exactly when he's coming back. And in verse 37, it says, "For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man." And Mr. Evans's point was the only thing we really knew for sure about the end time was that people would be marrying and giving in marriage. And he said, "You're going to clean up." Meaning that I would have work till the day Jesus Christ returned. Well, one of the most interesting things about that verse, and it's mentioned again in Luke 17, is that Jesus Christ considered the story of Noah and the ark just a part of the world, just a part of everyday life. Nowadays, the story of Noah's ark is a bit of a paradox in that it's a nice story to tell your children, and everybody grows up knowing who Noah was and what the ark was in that story. There are toys, many, many beautiful toys made of Noah's ark. We have a couple of books ourselves. We like to tell the stories, and one was a Caldecott medal winner, Noah's Ark, by a man named Peter Speer, happens to be a Dutch man. I love the illustrations in this, and just by looking at the pictures, and it's mostly pictures, I learn about God and about Noah, because I look at a detail and I think, and I go back and check the scripture, and there's a reason that Mr. Speer put that in his pictures. Now, this is my favorite. This is a book called The Ark by Matthew Reinhardt, and this is a pop-up book. And, you know, nowadays they can do amazing things, so we get the whole ark right there, and later we get all the animals and things. So, children, if after services you're interested in this, come on up and I'll tell you where your parents can order a copy. I'm not sharing this with you. I protect my pop-up books, but I happen to love this one. It's done pretty well, and it does bring an extra oomph to the story. It makes it more fun. But you know, there are two ways to look at it. Everybody likes to tell the story of Noah's Ark, because how can you go wrong? There's a family, and there's a boat, and there's a zoo, and there's kittens and rabbits and tigers and all kinds of things. And you're on a boat with all these animals that you've always wanted to be near. But you know, there's another way to look at it too. You could make a pretty compelling horror story out of Noah's Ark. I mean, in some ways, it's a beautiful story, and in some ways, it's a terrible story. So it ends up being a terribly beautiful story. But it's in all parts of the earth. Every part of the earth knows about the story of destroying the earth with a flood and of people coming through. Sometimes it's told with different names, different characters, different points in history. I know people are very happy to point out that the Babylonians had this story hundreds of years before the Hebrews did, and they had a man named Gilgamesh who was basically their Captain America, Captain Babylon, I guess was his name. Because like us today, I mean, look at our movie theaters. They're full of stories of superheroes. Well, Gilgamesh was also a superhero. And they ascribed to him the story of the flood, But it turns out that there are things not quite correct about that story, because it couldn't possibly have happened. I mean, it's basically a fairy tale the way that it's told, but it does have elements of truth in it. And it doesn't take away anything from the story that we have. People say, well, it was there hundreds of years, so it's the right story, and the Hebrew version is the wrong version. Well, no, it doesn't work that way at all. There are many, many, many versions. American Indians have a flood myth. The Aborigines in Australia have a flood myth. Tribes in Africa have a flood myth. Russia has a flood myth. Different countries in Europe have a flood myth. The Incas and Aztecs in South America had a flood myth. And the details are all over the map, literally and figuratively. But the point is, there was a flood story that everyone knows, which makes sense if you think that everyone on Earth is descended from a couple and their children who were in a flood. It makes sense that everyone would have that story, but they also embellish it over the years, and they get it wrong. And when the time came for God to tell Moses what to write in the first books of the Bible, apparently God gave him the version of the creation that is correct and the version of the flood story that is correct. So it doesn't matter that it was written down after the story of Gilgamesh, because the story of Gilgamesh was written down after Noah had lived through it. And after Noah lived for decades and decades and proudly told people about this story and would point to them up on the mountaintop where you could still see the ark at that point. Nowadays, there's reason to think there's still an ark, but we don't know for sure. There have been expeditions, but we don't have anything conclusive. It's a difficult area to get to. So it's an entertaining story for us. It has many things that appeal to us. And yet, I wonder if we understand it correctly. One of the things that I'm most looking forward to in the world tomorrow is taking courses and finding out exactly how things happened. And we'll read the same scriptures that we have today, but we'll see what they really meant, because there's room for different interpretations. And sometimes I wonder if there won't be a special course over in the corner, remedial, repairing the damage for the sermons that Mr. Graham gave, and all those things he tried to tell you. Here's how it really happened. And this is going to be one of those today. In that, there's things that I have thought about for a long time that I think are quite possible and make life and God's plan more exciting and more meaningful and tell us more about the character of God from reading the scriptures, and yet it might not necessarily be the way that we think about it. And one of the reasons is we think about the story of the flood from Noah's point of view, which makes sense from the point of the people who were on it, because we're people and we like that and we like to picture ourselves. But I think if we look at it also from God's point of view, we might pick up on a few things we missed from the past, and they might affect how we think about God and how we think about his plan. Now, I could talk about Noah and the flood for a long, long time. There are fascinating, fascinating things about it. There is evidence today that it happened, and yet it's not the evidence that we're used to. It's not the evidence that sometimes is presented. The Grand Canyon is not a remnant of Noah's flood. Noah's flood is recent enough, around 4,000 years ago, that anything evidence we see of it is in archaeology and anthropology, as opposed to geology, which is far, far older. And I'm going to have to assume, and I think I assume it correctly, that you know the story, and that you have read the scriptures, and that you know the details about Noah's Ark. And I think in this case, I'm safe doing that, because it's a story that we've all heard. Of course, we will check the scriptures, but we're going to have to race through them. And I'm going to have to depend on you, if you don't know the story, to read it. You know where it's found, and we'll start in Genesis 6. And we'll, for the most part, stay there, although there we'll have to refer to other parts of the scriptures too. In Genesis 6, what we see is that there were problems on the earth. We're familiar with that. I mean, we just look out at the world these days and we wonder what's going on sometimes. But up till this point, the earth was big enough and people were few enough that it was still a pretty nice place to live. But in chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, when people began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that they were fair, and they took wives for themselves of all that they chose. And the Lord said, and before we continue this, what I want to point out is that at this point, God has decided that there would be changes. God has decided that he didn't do everything the way that has turned out to be the right way, and he has made the supreme executive decision that he's going to make some changes. And it isn't just wiping out life on Earth. And it affected more than just life on Earth. Because, of course, before there ever was an Earth, there was a very active, vital, interesting spirit world, and still is, that exists outside of our physical cosmos. And there were many things that happened in the billions of years before the Earth even existed that are part of God's history and that God looks at all the time. So, in verse 3, God says, "My spirit will not abide in mortals forever," and there's a footnote that says, that's uncertain. So we know there's going to be some changes, but we're not quite sure what it means. "For they are flesh, their days shall be 120 years. It talks about giants that Mr. Shapiro was talking about were going to be on the earth. Of course, they drowned, but then it says they were also there later, and these were heroes of old, warriors of renown. Verse 5, "The Lord saw that wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually." So things had gotten to a very bad point. But I want to point out to you that he's going to make changes in human beings. They're not going to live as long as they used to. They're going to eat differently than from what we think they were. We're a little unclear on that, but there are going to be some changes. There are also going to be some changes in the animals, as we see, and God has decided at this point that things are going to be different. The time before the ark, the animals were different from after the ark, and he says that later on. But there were also some changes in his spirit world, and we're not quite sure what they are, but there was a giant shakeup. Whether it's connected to these Nephilim, we really don't know. It's one of the things that we're going to learn in the world tomorrow. And the church has some very clear and detailed writings on that. I think they've just been updated, and you can read those on your own. But Peter, who, of course, had heard Jesus talk about that Noah's Ark was a real story that really happened, that affected their lives even at that time, Peter mentions it twice. And I'm just going to give you the verses in 1 Peter 3:20 and 2 Peter 2, verses 4 through 6. Peter mentions that there was a shakeup in the spirit world and that it was connected to the time of Noah's Ark. And it probably had something to do with all the evil going on in the world, do you think? Since the Garden of Eden, Satan and his followers had been trying to subvert God's plan at that point. So there were things that were about to change, and it wasn't just people. It was also spirit beings. It was also animals. Number two, it was not just to destroy and start again. It was to start again differently. People were to change. Animals were to change. Viewed in the light of God's way of looking at things, you know, when we look at the world, we think, well, this is history. This has to continue. Once it's started, it can continue on forever. And it has to go on till the time when there's a nation of Israel, till the time when Jesus lives on earth, till the time, the end time when Jesus returns, till the time God's kingdom is established. It has to be a continuous story. But what God tells us here is that, no, it didn't have to be that way at all, that it could have been very different. In verse 6, "The Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." Now the next verse is very important, and we'll get there. But at this point, God isn't saying, I made mistakes, because God is God. But what God is saying is that this didn't work out the way that I had planned. I had very lofty vision of the way things would work out, starting from the time that we recreated the earth with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and it hasn't worked the way that it was supposed to. It wasn't God's fault that it hadn't worked, and that's why changes had to be made. But we think, you know, that God is obligated to continue things, and God is not. God made everything that we know. God could have ended it at that point. And it came very close to ending at that point. And the reason we know that is the things that God swore to human beings after it was all done. And so that is something to keep in mind. Now, another thing that I want to bring to your attention is that the animals were destroyed. Well, you say, well, we knew that. That's part of the story. And you're right. Of course, you do know that. But why destroy the animals? It says that all flesh was corrupted. And I know there's an apocryphal book of Enoch that says these animals did terrible, terrible, perverted things. But really, every animal on earth? I mean, okay, suppose animals could be improper and had to be destroyed. How about earthworms? Can they be improper? How about English sparrows? Can they be improper? Well, depending on what they do to my garden, I guess they could be. But what I mean is they're not evil creatures. And yet all of them were wiped out. All of them had to be at that point. God decided that they would be. And also remember that even though it doesn't mention it, remember that the plants probably died. Most of the plants probably died. I mean, my background, my training is in plants, and one of the things that we learned is that trees will die after about 4 weeks of flooding. Or it varies with the species, and there are some kinds that are very much adapted to the water and will live through things like that. But everything was covered with water for months and months and months, and although it doesn't mention it because the plants weren't corrupt, the plants died too. If God was bringing life back, he had a lot of work to do after this. So viewed in the light of redesigning life on earth, the purpose of the ark becomes something curiously, possibly different from what we think. Because you see, we think of God as creating life with his little hammer and tweezers and things, and nailing little antennae onto butterflies, and painting their wings, and things like that. But that's not really how God works. God works with proteins. God works with DNA. God works with RNA. God works with eggs and sperm and other things. That's God works in reproducing human beings. When God creates, really what he creates is the blueprint for these things. And then he has some special kind of mechanism, some special kind of protocol where he can make these things come into being. Because he says that these things will exist when the earth is created, and then they exist. But it doesn't mean that he's down there lining up vertebrae or things like that. God has a much greater, more magnificent way of doing things. We don't even know what it's like. But after Noah had been in the ark, consider this. Noah had been in the ark 40 days while it rained, 150 days after that, so we're talking months at this point. Then God seems to remember Noah, and what that means is then God turned his full attention to Noah, and then there were another 150 days before the ark came to rest. So we're talking months and months and months. We're talking a long period of time, and then there's that curious period of time where it seems like God isn't paying any attention to Noah, because at one point it says God remembered Noah and the ark and all the animals on it. Well, what was happening at that point? Life had died, the earth was covered with water, and the job of physical creation at that point was to decompose and to turn into a soup, that everything would come apart and that the building blocks would be there and then the materials would be there. How do I know this? Because it wasn't the first time that it had happened. This had actually happened before. This is not the first indication of replenishing the earth after a flood story. When the Bible opens in the very beginning, the Spirit of God is hovering over the earth, and the earth is covered with waters. And there had been millions and millions and millions of years of life before that, and it had suddenly been destroyed. And the materials were there. I mean, things had been torn apart and decomposed. But at the same time, God had some protocol, some kind of machine where he could enter the codes and where before God's eyes, not before any humans in that day, but the angels could rejoice over too. It says they did rejoice when God did all these things. Things appeared that the herds ran and the whales swam and the birds flew and the creeping things crept. And then there was a man and woman. God had some way of doing that, of taking all these nutrients, just a soup of nutrients, a blend of nutrients in superabundance, because it was everything that had lived on earth, and he had some kind of mechanism for making that manufacture life. And you can say, well, that's pretty far-fetched. You're making that up. If anyone want to say it? Well, it's why do I think that? And the reason is because that's how God works today. We have that mechanism today. Actually, we don't. Half of us have that mechanism today. I don't have it, but half of the people in this room do. half of the people in this room have in their bodies the capability to receive DNA coded and to take nutrients that come to them in a bloodstream supply in very small form and to build them into a human being. It's called a womb, and it's one of the greatest miraculous creations that God has done. But do we think about that? That also is probably a key to how God created the earth, and the womb reflects God's creation, not the other way around. So it makes the ark an entirely different thing. No longer do we have to have two of every color butterfly. All we need is the codes. All we need is two by two, or in more in the case of the clean and unclean animals, all we need is a complete representation of life on earth so that we have all the DNA there. You know, when God talks about the books of life and reading the books of life, it's always the books, isn't it? It's not the book of life. Well, one or two times it is. But it talks about the books of life, and I imagine that one of the books of life that God enjoys leafing through is really just a recipe book. Maybe it's called The Joy of Creating, or The Better Earth and Gardens Guide to Life on Earth, you know, where you can look at a hippopotamus and there's the entire code. And it can be narrowed down to just the minuscule amount of chromosomes. It's one of the most inspiring things on earth to me, that life can come from that kind of thing. And so what God needed on the ark, because he was going to make changes, was he needed the codes. He needed the DNA. I have something in my pocket that's very similar in a way. On my keychain, my son works for has a running store, and this is from the Saucony dealer. Saucony is a brand of running shoes and apparel. But what this really is, besides a very cool flashlight, is it's memory. And on this, I have every piece of music I've ever written. I have a book that I wrote in manuscript. I have a book that I am writing. I have all the chapters of it on here. I have family pictures on here. I have recorded music on here. It's amazing what I have on here. I have a couple books that I wouldn't ever want to be out without. And if my life were destroyed, and I hope it isn't, all I need is the right technology to plug this into, and I could recreate my world. Well, this is the ark. What God had on the ark was everything he needed to recreate the world. And you see, we run into a problem. If you picture the animals running off the ark and merrily skipping away or flying away, how did the kangaroos get to Australia? You can say, well, there was a land bridge, but why aren't they still in India? Why aren't they still in Turkey, where Ararat was? Why didn't some of them accidentally go to Europe? Well, you can say, well, God guided them, right? But they didn't get to Australia before they'd had many, many, many kangaroos on the way. And what we find is we find kangaroos in Australia, but we don't find them anywhere else. And the natural explanation for that is to say, well, they developed there over millions and millions of years, and there was no such thing as a flood. But an alternative explanation for those of us who know that there had to be a flood, and that Jesus Christ says there had to be a flood, and if we take Jesus Christ at his word, we know that there had to be a flood, and it wasn't magic, although it was supernatural, that somehow God replenished the earth with the animals in the places that they are now. And so what I propose happened is that after all that time, when God was planning how he would do this, he wasn't ignoring Noah. He hadn't forgotten Noah, but God and Jesus Christ and his staff had things to do in all those months before it says that his mind turned fully to Noah, that they were planning exactly how they would do that. The waters receded gradually, if you recall. God sent a mighty wind. They didn't just drain. Nobody pulled the plug and everything went, you know, down the tubes. And the reason is there was more water in the flood than exists on earth today. And so it had to be removed in some way, taken out to space or whatever, and it had to be done slowly. And that's why we don't see great damage from the flood, because the water was removed gradually. And so the siltation and things like that occurred gradually. And so we do have instances, geological instances, in the Mediterranean. I remember when I lived in Missoula, Montana, they used to call it the flood of Montana. There was, you could see on the mountains where the water had risen up to, because there was still a level on the mountains. And then it all drained very calamitously through the Columbia River Basin, and great damage and geological carving was done by that kind of thing. But that's not what happened with Noah's flood, and that's one reason that there's not as much evidence of it as we thought. Did you ever wonder why the ark came to rest? Let's look at that. In chapter 8, that the ark came to rest, God made a wind in verse 1, blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the waters of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters gradually receded from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated, and in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. So the ark is down. They could tell it was no longer, they were no longer needed their sea legs. The ark had stopped. It was sitting on a mountaintop. And then it said that the waters continued to abate for another 3 months, and the tops of the mountains appeared. And the water was only 15 cubits over the mountains. So this water going away was a very slow, gradual thing. And at the end of 40 days after that, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent out the raven, and it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. He never saw that raven again, it looks like. Did you ever ask yourself why Noah just didn't look? He opened the window. Why didn't he just look? He was on a mountaintop. Why couldn't he just see? Why did he have to send out a bird? Well, because God was doing things in his own way, and Noah couldn't see it. Maybe it was just the architecture of the ark blocked him. Who knows? I mean, this is one of those things that's going to be taught over in the corner in the world tomorrow. But he waited another 7 days, and he sent out a dove, and the dove didn't come back. And then he sent out a dove again, and by that time, God had replenished the earth and repopulated the earth. The plants were alive again, and Noah knew not just that the waters had subsided from the earth, but he knew that God had done what God needed to do, and it brought back life to the earth at that point. God had been in this situation before. He no longer had to make a firmament. He no longer had to do some of the other things. He didn't have to make the sun, moon, and the stars. They weren't damaged or changed in any way. But he ran the protocols that he had run at the creation week and replenished the earth. But he made things different, and the promises are worth looking at. In verse 20 of chapter 8, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird, of which he had many at this point. The chickens had gone overtime in producing little chicklets, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of humankind. That's a very interesting sentence. God didn't curse the ground for the ark. In Noah's time, God didn't curse the ground. That was back in the Garden of Eden. So what God is saying is, it's going to be different now. I've changed my mind. We're going to be doing things differently. For the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And that's very encouraging to us, because what God's saying is, I'm not going to interrupt history anymore, but what he's also saying is that the inclination of human heart is evil from youth. The earth will get worse. People will get worse. But it's going to be different now. And I'm not going to interrupt. I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to make a covenant that I will never do this again. Because before that, he could. But now he's promising that it won't happen again. And that's vitally important to us, because we could wake up every day wondering if there's going to be a flood. We don't have to, because we know that there's not. Chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth. So the animals are different. Something has been changed in the makeup of these animals. On every bird of the air, on everything that creeps on the ground, on all the fish of the sea, into your hand are delivered. You know, there were some creatures probably who lived through in the water, who lived through the flood. And what are the friendly creatures? What are the ones that you kind of wish wouldn't be so friendly to man, the ones that didn't have to change so much? The dolphins and the seals and the seabirds and things that might have lived through all that kind of thing. Just an interesting thing to think about. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. We don't know if that was true before or not, but we know now that the meats that God said we can eat, we can now eat, and that human beings are made to eat meat. Just as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But here's the catch. You shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, with its blood. From now on, I'm going to have a reckoning for every act of murder, every act of the wrong kind of violence. From now on, it's going to be required that your lifeblood will be required as a reckoning. And when you read through when God created his own nation, even accidental deaths, people had to pay a penalty for that kind of thing. There were ways around it with a red heifer and things like that, but this was very important to God. In verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of a human, by a human shall that person's blood be shed, for in his own image God made humankind. And he's saying that as much to himself as he is to us, because God's saying, I have a purpose. You're made in my image. This has to go somewhere, and no longer will I interrupt. And so he says in verse 7, and you be fruitful and multiply, abound on the earth and multiply in it. As for me, in verse 8, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you and with everything that lives on the earth. Verse 11, I establish my covenant that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And then he talks about the sign in the clouds, which is the rainbow. Now, you and I know that there were rainbows before Noah's flood. Well, we don't know that. Not even Mr. Thomas was around at that point. We do not know. But judging just by the way the earth works, there's no reason that there weren't rainbows before. But what God is saying is, when I see that rainbow, and he sees them all the time, it will remind me constantly of what I'm carrying out and what has to happen now and will come to its fruition. And you know, one of the few things we know about where God exists today, one of the few things we know from the book of Ezekiel and from the book of Revelation, is that around his throne is a rainbow, that there's rainbow light. And we don't know if it was there before the flood. I mean, he probably has a decorating staff, but he and Jesus Christ probably make a lot of those decisions themselves. And perhaps if that was the point where they said there will be a rainbow around our throne from now on, because the only instances we have from it are from many years after this has ever happened. But when I say God has this continual in his mind, it's before his throne. He doesn't have any choice. He's put it there. And it's forever on his mind that he's not going to do this thing again. But, you know, all God did was slow things down. Because what's the first thing that happens after the earth is recreated? Noah commits a sin. Canaan commits a sin. I don't even want to get into the depths of what happened. But human beings lived up to what God said, that their heart is wicked and will be forever. And so the next big story that we come to is the Tower of Babel. And that's just important in its own way. Because now God can't destroy the earth. Things are starting to look as though they're going a different direction than he intended again. So what does he do? He slows it down. He makes changes that slow down the progress of mankind. And so the earth has played out the way that it has. And of course, the spirit world has had its effect on the earth. We know from the book of Daniel that many of the world civilizations that have been on the earth, Greece, Rome, Assyria, Babylon, that they have had some inspiration from the spirit world. Now, God says that very clearly, and Jesus Christ believed in that just as much as he did that the story of Noah had taken place quite literally. But what do we see when this plan comes to an end? What do we see? Back in Matthew 24, that verse where we started, where Jesus Christ talks about the ark, Matthew 24, a chapter about the end time, that if you haven't read for a while, it would be very good if you did, because this is talking about an earth that if it doesn't exactly describe what's happening on today, these times are coming very soon. In Matthew 24, and Jesus is the one who brings Noah into this story and says, it's on my mind, you know, it's going to be just like Noah. The progression has gone on. It's part of the same story. Matthew 24, verse 22. And this is a verse that we used to know by heart. If those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days would be cut short. In other words, God says the world is still destroying itself, but I'm not going to be the one to do it this time. It's going to happen. I do remember one time, I don't remember if it was Greg Thomas or Greg Sargent, but explaining that the word elect was really an abbreviation for electricians, because they were both electricians, and it was for the sake of the electricians, that those days will be short. But that, of course, was a bunch of hooey, and we don't even need a course in the world tomorrow about that. Because everybody, as someone in Montana said to me, if everybody knows you're lying, then that's called a joke. And that was a joke. But God's very serious about that. If it wasn't for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. The elect matter. God doesn't have any control about who chooses his way. And that is the real miracle of Noah's story. If we turn back to Genesis 6, because God could control all kinds of things in this story, and whether I have them correct or not, all I want you to do is expand your mind and think about the way things could be. I'm willing to be wrong. I don't want to contradict Scripture in any way, but I like to make people think, and I like to shake up your thinking on certain things. But this is something that you can't argue with, and that's true. In chapter 6 of Genesis and verse 8, the key verse in this whole story is, "But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord." Because God didn't control the fact that Noah came along at this point. Noah was there. And it says in verse 9, yes. "These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God." You can pay a man no higher compliment, a man or woman, no higher compliment than to say he walked with God. And there are only two people in the Bible that says that of. The other is Enoch, who was Noah's great-grandfather. Their lives didn't actually overlap. Enoch had died by the time Noah was born. But Noah certainly heard the stories of his great-grandfather who walked with God and delighted God. And God was very happy. Well, Noah walked with God. It does say of Abraham that he walked in God's law, and it says that also of John the Baptist's father, Zechariah. So, you know, we all have to walk with God. The Bible also says that. But Noah was one who that's accorded to. It says, can you imagine having that written in Scripture about you? I mean, Noah made it, and that's why it can say in the book of Ezekiel that if you're talking about righteous people, you're talking about Noah and Daniel and Job. In the book of Hebrews, it's why Noah ends up in the list of the faithful, because he's already walked with God. And his life is done, but, you know, in God's eyes, Noah's still a part of his family. Well, it's the same way in the end time. The fate of the world hinges on there being elect. Now, God calls us. You know, we can't take the credit for God giving us life and God giving us the chance, but it does depend on people making that choice. And the reason God is going to intervene in the world is because there will be righteous people in their own kind of ark, God's way of life at that point. And so God looks at it all as one story. He sees it from before he made the earth the first time, all the way through the creation of the earth, through Noah and his ark, through all the other things that have happened, and right up to today, right up to this point in history where everything else is in the future. But the future of the world depends on the elect. One indication that Noah's always a part of God's thinking is that every one of you has reminded God of Noah, at least every one of you who has been baptized. Why did God choose water as the symbol of death? It's part of that story. It's a reflection of what happened in the days of Noah. So every time that God and the angels rejoice because a new person has come into his family and been given the gift of his Holy Spirit, there's an echo of Noah at that point. If you'll turn to Isaiah 54:9, it isn't just ancient history. It's very much a part of God's thinking in everything that he does. And he proves it rather emphatically in this chapter. In Isaiah 54, it's a long chapter, but it says, "Sing, O barren one who did not bear, burst into song and shout, you who have not been in labor." And this is a chapter that you can read yourselves. It talks about how God has punished the nation of Israel and that they have suffered disgrace and widowhood, figurative widowhood. But in verse 5, God says his attitude will change on that. He will never forget. "For your maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. The Holy One of Israel is your redeemer. The God of the whole earth he is called. For God has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, like the wife of a man's youth when she is cast off, says your God. For a brief moment I abandoned you," just as he left Noah in the ark for a while, but for different reasons. "But with great compassion I will gather you." So this is talking about leading up to the end time. "In overflowing wrath for a moment I hid my face from you. you. It had to be done. But with everlasting love, I will have compassion on you, says the Lord your Redeemer. And what does he compare it to, this time leading up to when he will restore Israel? Verse 9, this is like the days of Noah to me. Just as I swore that the waters of Noah would never again go over the earth, I have sworn that I will not be angry with you and will not rebuke you. For the mountains may depart and the hills be removed, but my steadfast love will not depart from you. My covenant of peace shall not be removed, says the Lord, who has compassion on you. And of course, the covenants have been updated a bit too, as you know. This is talking about a time in the end. In verse 17, it ends by saying, this is the heritage of the servants of the Lord and their vindication from me, says the Lord. But it shows you that the story of Noah became part of God's character. And all the good things that he has in store, all the great and wonderful things that he is going to do for this earth, are linked to the days of Noah.